Who let the dogs out?
Who let the dogs out?
It's time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Milton Veterinary Practice, traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine, 518-789-3440, MillertonVet.com. With us today, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, owner and chief vet at the Milton Veterinary Practice. Hello, Dr. Cannon.
Good morning, Jill.
Questions.
How can I help today?
Oh, you're going to save the world, starting with Gabe and Michael in Pine Plains. What could be causing the chronic middle ear infections in our dog? He's a Dachshund Cocker Spaniel mix, 2 years old, sick of going to the vet for this. And I just, how do you know middle ear?
Middle ear, of course, otitis externa is what we see most commonly, and that is the external part of the ear. The ear canal is actually pretty long in a big dog. In a small dog, too, reference to their
size.
Their size. But the ear canal goes fairly vertically and then horizontally into the eardrum. And so anything on the outside of the eardrum is the external ear canal, and anything on the other side of the eardrum, the first section on the other side of the eardrum, is the middle ear, and that's otitis media. I think that's what they're talking about, chronic middle ear infections. And so it's behind the eardrum. So if the eardrum has ruptured because of the otitis externa, has just gotten really bad and caused the eardrum to rupture, that is how the middle part of the ear is introduced to infection. And you see a lot of pain there, head tilting very often. Sometimes some dogs are off balance as well. Otitis interna is even farther in the bony part of the ear, inside the skull. But we're talking here about middle ear. So these dogs are much more bothered. So a lot more scratching at the ear, some head tilt, some whining when they scratch because it hurts. And it is sometimes you will have a middle ear infection that where the eardrum isn't ruptured. And so you'll see a bulging eardrum, a red eardrum, with the scope on the outside. And that can be introduced through the eustachian tube, potentially, or there can be problems with polyps and tumors in that area. So most of these infections are not primary. It's not that the ear all of a sudden decides to become infected. It's way in there. It's either because your dog has chronic otitis in that canal part of the ear, or there are allergies that inflame the whole ear and can cause problems with the middle ear. So it starts with inflammation. So there's inflammation either in the external ear canal, and then it goes into the middle ear, or it may start in the middle ear. And that's usually caused by an allergy of some kind. So that's what you have to think about, is what's causing this? What is the underlying cause?
And can you tell because it's smelly or just itchy? Or what causes the brown stuff? Is it middle ear, or is it just regular?
You can't tell. You can't tell by looking whether a dog has a layperson can't tell by looking. You have to look inside the ear canal and see that either the eardrum's bulging or it's ruptured. And sometimes we can't tell that because there's so much inflammation in the external ear canal, you can't see in far enough, either because of the swelling or because of the gunk that's in there. And so, this sounds like chronic middle ear infections typically would be, number one, first thing you need to do is really get rid of the infection. And that involves culturing. So you've got to culture the ear. You have to see what you've got in there, and you need to treat it really aggressively. Almost always you need to use corticosteroids to get rid of a middle ear infection as well. So topical and potentially oral as well. Because you're dealing with a pretty severe allergy. But these chronic things that, that these people are talking about, trying to get to the underlying cause is key. You have to have your veterinarian talk to you about perhaps, you know, number one, is the skin inflamed also? Do you want to pursue allergy injections, the hyposensitization injections? Do you want to talk about a hypoallergenic, quote-unquote, diet, maybe a change in diet? Definitely Chinese herbal medicine can help with this kind of thing, but you do need to get rid of the infection with allopathic. You know, you need to use antibiotics, absolutely, because these ears are very infected. So lots of inflammation, lots of infection. So, you know, I'm hoping that the veterinarian's talking about what is the underlying cause, what can we do about that. You know, let's make sure we get completely rid of the infection that's in there, let things heal up, and then what do we do for the long run to prevent it? So I can't really, I guess, be specific unless I knew more information.
Right. So, but so I guess what we would say to Gabe and Michael, who are sick of going to the vet for this, is, hey, are you pursuing allergies? Have you talked to the vet about allergies and what the underlying cause is? Has the vet recommended Chinese or anything? Has the vet cured the,
So is the infection actually getting fixed, and the eardrum is intact? And X-rays should have been done to make sure that there's not maybe an inner ear tumor also. So that's a possibility. So you have to do those X-rays under anesthesia, so we don't, you know, we're not doing them at a first visit, but you're doing them potentially with chronic problems. And there are dogs who have such chronic middle ear, inner ear troubles or tumors or chronic polyps in there that they need to have a total ear canal ablation. It's called a TICA surgery. Excuse me. And it's done by a specialist, and they actually remove the entire ear canal.
Okay. But it's a Dachshund Cocker 2 years old. I mean, is that typical, or is it?
It's not typical to need, you know, to have a growth, certainly a tumor in there at that age.
Right.
It is something usually that can be treated medically. It just has to be treated aggressively. So, you know, it means repeated veterinary visits in order to get to the bottom of the problem. And what I see is that people get tired of that. So they see their dog a little bit better. And this may not be the case here. They see their dog a little bit better, and then they don't come back.
Right.
For the exams. And so it's very hard for us to sometimes get to the bottom of things because we don't have compliance.
And that is so true. I mean, again, if I had a nickel for everybody who took one pill and thought it would be done,
then there's the cost, you know. So the cost of returning for all kinds of treatment once a week, and this is where, you know, insurance is such a wonderful thing. If you got insurance, it is even, you know, not for routine problems, but for something like this that pops up. Once you've spent your deductible, you know, if you're talking about something like Trupanion, a company like Trupanion or Nationwide, Trupanion will pay 90% of every visit that you have for that particular problem. And if you're talking about a 2-year-old dog, you know, that's going to be a very expensive issue for them over the years, but it's not going to be for you. So you can continue to go, get to the bottom of the problem, and, you know, potentially find a way to manage it so it's not chronic. So your dog's not in pain. So that's my soapbox about pet insurance.
All right. So what I'm going to translate and see if you agree for Gabe and Michael is A, get unsick of going to the vet. B, get insurance. And C, then pursue the regular visits and more probably the allergies or whatever is causing the discovery of what's causing it.
Yes, yes. So the time, of course, to get the insurance is when you have a puppy who's got no pre-existing conditions.
Of course.
So, you know, with this history here, you won't get insurance for the ear ever. So they just won't insure it.
Okay.
Because it's pre-existing, but that's why I got on my soapbox, because I think it's a wonderful thing if you can afford the, you know, you can choose your plan and do the monthly thing, and it's kind of this savings for the catastrophic stuff or the repeat stuff that happens with your dog. You know, it's the $40 a month or whatever that you're putting in to avoid these thousands later on.
Right. Okay. Mary in Astoria, Queens, on a similar topic, I love my dog, and I'm worried that she won't live long because she's a King Charles Cavalier, and I heard they genetically are prone to heart failure. What can I do to be sure she never strains her heart?
You know, I don't think it's a matter of straining her heart. I think it's a matter of the gene expression. And so if, in fact, she has the genes that for the heart disease that, and usually it starts with a heart murmur for the King Charles Cavalier. So it's an enlarged heart with a murmur. And so that's something that you might want to consider having your veterinarian do an exam and listen to her heart a couple of times a year instead of once. I think that some people choose to do an echocardiogram on a regular basis. That's an ultrasound of the heart to look at the valves, to look at the heart and see how strong it is, see how it's contracting, et cetera. But I don't think that the recommendation would be to do that prior to 4 years of age. So that's something that you could start at 4 or 5, talk to the cardiologist, say that you want to be proactive. You want to feed a really good diet. I guess the recommendation now would be to avoid a grain-free diet because some of the ingredients have been, such as lentils and peas, have been originally associated with potential heart problems in dogs. I don't know why we don't have better research on that at this point. Maybe there's just no money for it, but nobody really knows at this point what is really the cause of this cardiomyopathy that we've been seeing. Actually, we haven't been seeing. The cardiologist noticed a slight uptick in, I don't know if this is a new subject for us, but a slight uptick in cardiomyopathy, meaning problems with the heart muscle, and gathered all of this information. This is probably 6 years old now, this story. And one of the tying factors, the common factors with many of these dogs is that they were on quote-unquote grain-free diets. So what I don't know is how many dogs were actually on grain-free diets back then, and you know, and really what does it have to do with cardiomyopathy? That's still, the jury is out on that. So to be safe, dogs who are genetically prone to heart disease should not be on a grain-free diet. And so that's something that you could do. But otherwise, I would say ask the breeder if he or she has had heart disease in their line, and then you have to just stop worrying about it.
Right. And
but good exercise is good. There's nothing you're really going to do as far as putting a strain on the heart with a young dog.
Okay, and it sounds like this would be an opportunity to also get insurance, and then you can go have those tests. Would you say that? Or
right,
not?
Yeah. But, so I would guess, check it out, absolutely, when you have a young, healthy puppy.
Right. And then I think the other thing that you said is so key. Do not spend your – try to avoid spending your time worrying about it. Just love your dog and have a good time. All right. Rain in Poughkeepsie. Why do – this is like, Mom, why do I have to get my kittens vaccinated for so many diseases if they're never going to go outdoors?
Yeah, that's a common, fairly common question, actually. So rabies, of course, is mandated by the states. And in fact, cats do get outdoors. And when they get out, if they're indoor cats, they tend to take off for a couple of days and they come home with bites. And then it's really problematic if your cat is not vaccinated and up to date on rabies vaccine. The other thing is that people find bats in their homes dead on the floor, don't know whether the cat bit the bat bit the cat. We don't know any of that. And then everyone's afraid that their cat might get rabies if they haven't had a rabies vaccine. So common sense and the law there. The kittens very often will get out. You know, it's easy for them, especially if you've got kids in the house, to get out. So kittens are more prone to feline leukemia virus than adult cats. And so typically what we'll do, if you're going to have an indoor kitty, we'll just give your kitten the initial leukemia vaccine. They tend to become less and less susceptible as they get older. So initial leukemia vaccine, just in case they're going to get out. And then the RCP every 3 years. So it's rhinotracheitis, calicivirus, and panleukopenia. The first two are respiratory diseases that can be transmitted between cats. So if you've got, if your kitty, number one, if your kitty gets out, if you've got a screened-in porch, if you've got other cats hanging around, that is a potential problem. Panleukopenia is a parvovirus, and that's something that you can actually bring, people can bring into the house on their shoes on what we call fomites, so pieces of material that can carry the virus in. Those three kitty viruses can make your cat very, very sick. And so it's somewhat of an insurance policy. If your cat gets very, very sick, you know, you're talking about if it's not lethal, which panleukopenia can be, then you're talking about, you know, a week or two of hospitalization, which will, which can put people in the poorhouse.
Speaking of insurance. So,
yeah, compared to vaccinating. So, yeah, I think it's a good idea. I don't take the chance with my own kitties. I do go ahead and vaccinate. I don't continue with the leukemia vaccine if they're going to be indoor kitties.
Right.
But
and also, rumor has it, and I think that this is an apt time to mention it, that you and your practice go out of the way to find vaccines that aren't as diabolical.
We do investigate what are the vaccines that are they're going to cause least side effects. That's true. And the rabies vaccine, it's important, I think, to have a PureVax rabies, meaning it doesn't have a lot of adjuvant, which is the extra stuff they put in the vaccine to call it the attention of the immune system. And it is speculated that the adjuvant may be part of the cause for cats to get tumors from vaccination. So when we used to give all of our vaccines at the base of the neck, in that loose skin there, we found that there were a number of cats, and I can't give you the percentages, who actually would get a fibrosarcoma in that spot. Some of these cats never actually were vaccinated, but they just had a needle puncture for like an antibiotic injection or subcutaneous fluids, you know, those kinds of things, but all in the same spot. So nowadays, we move things around. We give the leukemia vaccine in the left hind leg. We give the rabies in the right hind leg. We give the RCP in the right front area if we possibly can. Sometimes we can't get that close, depending on the kitty.
Right.
But so we're actually keeping track. The vaccines have been, some vaccines have been made better, non-adjuvanted. And so, you know, I can't say that I've seen a case of fibrosarcoma in a cat. I shouldn't say. I should knock on wood, but it's been many, many, many years.
Well, let's knock on wood, but just it's something for owners to be aware of and to ask about, because
right,
as with everything, the less additive or fancy word,
right,
the better.
And it is called feline vaccine-associated sarcoma, and it was a real problem 20, 25 years ago. And
yeah,
now is not so much of one. But it is something to think about, of course. You don't want to put something in your pet that's not necessary. And so if you've got a cat who's living indoors who's had two or three RCP vaccines, I typically won't continue with it. You know, I stop them early before they get to be older. Rabies vaccine, you do need to continue.
And do you titer cats as well, or as dogs?
We can titer cats. The titers are fairly expensive.
Okay.
So most people don't go for that. And I think that most likely they're going to have pretty good immunity after, you know, if we're doing it every 3 years and they've had their kitten vaccines and then three adult cats, that puts them at, about 11 years old, something like that, then I'm usually ready to stop that. But it depends on their exposure. If cats are going outdoors, I'll continue it.
Robin Colton in New York City. I think I know. The other day on a walk, our dog ate something so horrible you probably can't say it on the radio. Suffice it to say, we were in a big urban park with no public bathrooms. Maybe you could tell us if there is something you can force a dog who has done such a thing to eat or rinse with to fully decontaminate their mouth. Thanks.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, the bacteria... the bacteria in dog's mouth is pretty nasty to begin with. What I would say is to maybe try to get in there and brush their teeth. And then, or you can use some of that healthy mouth water additive. It's tasteless, and do that for, you know, do that for a few days. But I think that if you're going to try to rinse their mouth out, I would just do that with water, lots and lots of water in a syringe.
All right, and I will say that happened to me, as I say so often, I'll just say decades ago, and my brother had the line of the moment when he said, "And you brought her home?"
Yeah, I mean, they'll eat all kinds of poop. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it really
matter
doesn't.
What it is, cat poop. Cat poop's pretty disgusting itself.
Oh, yeah, that you just get used to. But I will say this. You never minded them eating horse poop.
Right. So, well, that's an herbivore. So
I understand
a little less
it's an herbivore, but I just, you know, so the way that some dogs tuck in, you know, by the way, I'm going to do a quick Ask the Vet question. Is there such a thing as too much horse poop?
There's such a thing as too much of anything.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, they can if they're constantly eating horse manure and it's got a lot of grain in it, that can cause constipation.
Right, especially if they're on grain-free diets.
Right. So the horse, you know, if the horses are dropping grains and, you know, they're not grinding it very well, if it's an older horse or whatever, then you can get corn in there, and so yeah, and plus your dog can eat a lot of horse manure and then not eat their regular food, so there is such a thing as too much.
Okay, and time for one more question. The name throws me off. This is from April in Poughkeepsie, but her name really should be June or August. And is hot pavement different for dog feet than human feet? In other words, if the sidewalk is too hot for me to be barefoot, are my puppy's paw pads too hot?
Yes. The answer is yes, absolutely. So if you can't go barefoot on the pavement, then your dog shouldn't be able to go barefoot on the pavement, or we will get burns.
All right,
and when the pads are burned, they blister, and the blister falls off, and they're red and sore and very difficult to deal with and very painful.
Yeah, and I did that to a puppy once, the first Shark, actually. He just took a long, long, hot walk, and I was not barefoot, so... But
you didn't realize.
Right, I didn't, but it was definitely... You do it once, and it's something that you never do again.
Right. So, yeah, you need to get them along the sidewalk on the grass, or I guess in the city there isn't always grass. Yeah, I don't know how to solve that except for getting them with booties to a spot where they can be off the pavement.
Don't they, I don't know, don't they sweat in booties?
They do, but how do you do that? I haven't ever lived in New York, so how do you walk your dog if
early,
they can't go?
Early in the day. And late in the evening,
when the pavement is not so hot, and you find
shade, which is actually doable. But it's the important thing is that it's something that you are aware of, because if you just drag them out, you know, in a blistering sidewalk, you're gonna have
blisters.
Yeah, I got blisters on my fingers. Thank you very much, Dr. Cannon. We really appreciate
it. My pleasure. Thank you.
This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.
Who let the dogs out? Who let the dogs out? Who?